Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM.
WMTB LP St. Petersburg.
Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
All right, thank you for joining us. We are thrilled to have with us Boston area singer-songwriter Mark Stepakoff, who's widely admired on the local folk and roots music scene for his trademark mix of wry humorous material and poignant ballads, in the vein of songwriters such as Loudon Wainwright III and John Prine, to whom he has often been compared. He's won numerous songwriting awards, and his songs have reached as high as number 3 on the National Folk Radio Airplay charts. He has headlined on a number of occasions at Club Passine, and also Tupelo Music Hall and the Bluebird Cafe. Among the artists he's opened for are Bill Morrissey, Steve Forbert, Christine Lavin, Cheryl Wheeler, and the James Montgomery Band. And among numerous other songwriting awards, Mark is a 13-time winner in American Songwriting Magazine competitions, including 2 first prizes. Mark Stepakoff, thank you for joining us on Song Creating.
Well, thanks, Steve. Nice to be here with you.
Well, it's great to have you. So, give us a little bit of background on your musical career and what propelled you into this whole thing.
All right. My musical career. Let me think about that. For me, I would say, you know, I've been playing music around town and writing songs for a long time now. But having said that, it was a pretty slow build. I was a music fan, kind of music obsessed for a long time before I was actually playing music.
Or now, are we talking about back in songs. Childhood and high school years?
Yeah, I would. If you really want to go granular on it, I would. I would really trace it back. In all seriousness, to it would have been like January of 1972. I was 11. I was in the 7th grade, and. And I still have a pretty vivid memory of this. So I was sick for a few days. I had the flu. I was laid up in bed, and I was bored, and didn't have a lot to do. I had a clock radio in my room, and so just out of boredom, I tuned it to what I knew was the top 40, or more like top 30, pop station in Boston at the time, which was WRKO. Everyone in the early 70s listened to WRKO, the Big 68. And, you know, I liked music. I was very cognizant of music, but I hadn't really, you know, listened intently to the radio until then. And over the course of those few days, I think because they played the same songs over and over and they would get stuck in your head. And also because, and this is a longer conversation, but... I think 1972 was really one of the great unsung years in pop music history. There were just great, great songs on the radio back then. Songs by established artists and new artists and one-hit wonders and great soul music on the radio. And so within a few days, all those songs were in my head. And I just really became obsessed with that. And when I went back to school, I snuck a little transistor radio with me and, you know, would put the earphone in my ear whenever I could. And pretty soon after that, I started buying 45s. My mom would take me down to the local Woolworths a couple times a week. And I still remember a 45 at Woolworths was 77 cents. And I just thought that was the greatest thing in the world, that for 77 cents you could own forever a song that they played on the radio. That was so cool. It sort of blew my mind. And then as the weather started turning nicer, I would ride my bike down there and grab 45s. And so and then as time went on, you know, my the age I was, and you know, as my listening taste progressed, it probably coincided pretty well with what was happening on the radio scene generally. So I sort of went from, you know, AM top 40 to FM top 40 to FM progressive to eventually college radio. But I was always, you know, music obsessed. I listened to music all the time. Mm-hmm. At some point I stopped buying 45s and started buying albums. And, but I never really, played music, until after I went off to college. When I went to college, I sort of, you know, gravitated toward other musicians. And so soon after that, I started playing guitar and, you know, jamming with other musicians. And it wasn't long after that before I started writing. I sort of felt like I had the ability to write very early on as I started playing. I think it was from listening to so many songs. I sort of had what I thought was sort of an intuitive sense of song structure and that kind of thing. So
what was you, you and I are in the, kind of the same age bracket. Were you into the folk, like the James Taylor, Dan Fogelberg at that time, or were you more gravitating to
I would say it was more pop and rock, and so I definitely listened to that. It was, you know, it was everywhere, and a lot of my friends did, and I liked all that. I liked, you know, Jackson Browne and, you know, the Eagles and, you know, everyone of that ilk. But I would say it was more kind of pop, rock, and soul for me at that point. So anyway, you know, by that point I started writing, and a couple of my songs got covered by people that played at the college pub. That felt pretty good at the time. Yeah, that was cool. And so, so I started, you know, writing and playing with some regularity, mainly just really to amuse my friends and family. I didn't really go out and play, you know, in public. And I didn't really do that for a long time. And after a while, I sort of made like a homemade cassette of what I thought were my best songs at the time. You know, I liked them at the time. In retrospect, they probably weren't very good. But I would distribute those to my friends, and people liked them. And so, you know, eventually, I was kind of blissfully ignorant that there was any sort of a scene or open mic scene or anywhere where you could go out and play. But eventually, around the time, probably around the year 2000, I kind of figured that out, and I started frequenting a couple open mics, really, and became sort of a little bit of the open, you know, took place in the open mic scene that was centered around Passim at the time, and also TCAN, the Center for Arts and Natick, and they both had very vibrant scenes, and I started playing my material out, and within that very small circle, I got a little bit of recognition at the time. I've always written kind of a combination of humorous and more serious songs, but back then I sort of quickly realized that not many people were playing humorous songs on that scene, and so I played a lot of those, and it gave me sort of maybe a little bit of a niche, and so I met a lot of other songwriters. That was the best part about that, you know, many of whom are still, you know, dear friends to this day, and people started saying, "Oh, you should make a CD," and so on, and so I just sort of one thing led to another, and. And that brought me to where I am today, Steve. that was kind of my background. The main point I was trying to convey was I was a music fan for a long time before I played or wrote music.
When you were a kid and as tuned in as you were to music, you didn't play an instrument, but how did music? How did you react to the music?
I was obsessed with it. I really was. I listened all the time, and I read a lot. You know, a lot of my reading as a teenager was about music and, you know, the history of popular music and rock and roll. And I thought about it all the time because I think the reason was these songs were having such an effect on me. They really were, you know, helping me get through my adolescence. And so I thought a lot about why that is and what makes a song work and why does a certain song resonate with me. And because a lot of, you know, at some level, obviously the songs, you know, were, you know, frequently tackling more mature themes than I could possibly think. For example, going back to 1972, I remember one of the 45s I bought, you know, later that year was, do you remember the song, Good Time Charlie's Got the Blues?
Oh, sure.
Okay. And so, you know, so I was 12 by when that song came out, and I remember, you know, there's that line, you know, my heart keeps telling me you're not a kid at 33. And, you know, for some reason, I love that line. And I'm not sure I even had the right perspective on it because, you know, what do you mean you're not? Of course you're not a kid at 33. Everybody knows that. You know, you're a kid when you're 12, you know. But my point is I was constantly thinking of the songs in terms of how they were structured. Even at that age, I realized, you know, that it made a difference if they had a bridge or didn't have a bridge or how many verses they are, whether they had a hard stop or whether they faded out. All of that, I was just constantly attuned to, you know, how the songs were structured, how they worked. And I do think that that informed my songwriting later on because having listened to and sort of analyzed in my head as best I could at that age.
You sound like you were more a budding producer. You really attuned to that whole.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just very. I think it's because music and popular songs had such an effect on me.
Yeah.
That I was trying to sort of analyze why that was, and you know what songs worked in particular and why.
Were there kids in your school that had rock bands that you knew? Did you hang with them?
Or? Yeah, not a lot. I mean, you know, there were some that played in bands, but most of my friends again were listeners. We would listen to records together. Nobody was as obsessed about it as I was. But I didn't know. I think that was one of the reasons it took me a while to be a musician, because I didn't know a lot of people that were playing music well. You know, I didn't. But once I got to college, sort of, I gravitated toward a bunch of other guitar players, and then we would all sort of hang out, and I could see what they were doing, and I was able to pick it up at that point.
So before you started learning guitar, did you know what a coda was, or I mean?
Yeah,
could you follow written music and understand?
No, not in that sense. I mean, okay. I could tell you what a coda to a song is. I wouldn't have been able to name it.
You didn't know what it was called, but you knew
exactly. I knew that was one approach to ending a song. Right? Yeah. Exactly. Right. And I thought a lot about, oh, this song ends this way, this song ends that way. You know, and even I think, and I wouldn't have been able to use the word, but you know, if a song modulated, I knew that there was something
you
that
felt
was different. Exactly. And I would think about that. Why is that? Why does that last verse sound different, like it's higher, you know?
Wow.
So I was music obsessed.
You know, it's really interesting to hear that coming from someone who wasn't playing an instrument, because it just seems like that's kind of part of what you, as you play, you get it. So it's great, you know, as listening. So this music had a real effect on you. If there was one song that, you'll never be able to narrow it down to one, I'm sure, but if there was one song or a couple songs or maybe one band that really had the most effect on you, what would that be?
Well, I mean, at that age, at a very young, I mean, later on I got into, you know, Dylan and Springsteen and all of that, but you know,
these are your formative years.
Back when I was 11 or 12, you know, well, first of all, I mean, in 1972, the biggest pop star in the world was Elton John, you know, so, but I remember the first song that really had an impact on me. I'm not even sure why, other than it's such a beautiful, beautiful production. It's one of the best arranged and produced pop songs I've ever heard, soul songs. Was the Shy Life song, Have You Seen Her, which to this day is one of my favorite songs. It's so haunting, and of course I hear it very differently now than I did when I was 11.
When you were writing in college, were your chord structures pretty basic and you were just filling in? You were writing lyrically?
Yeah, my chord structures were pretty basic, and they've been pretty basic ever since.
Yeah.
But I try, you know, I mean, but I'm always conscious of the fact that it's not poetry. You need melody and rhythm and so on.
Yeah.
So I always try to, you know, as best I can, marry the two, but it's, you know, it's clearly lyric oriented.
Did you write poetry as
a
kid?
No.
English major?
No, I didn't. And I still, to this day, I don't really. You know, there's some, you know, I like some poetry, but in general, it certainly doesn't move me the way that music does. I feel like, you know, to me, you know, just what hits me is words that have, you know, a melodic, you know, a rhythmic sense to them.
Yeah. So do you find yourself, when you are writing and you know, even, for instance, this song, well, I think the song we're going to talk about is definitely more lyrical in its priorities than the music side of it, but do you sit down with a song prompt, and do you go through these processes of writing songs that way? And if you do, are they more, you start with the lyrics?
I get that question a lot, and I guess you could say I start with the lyrics. I always have an idea, a lyrical idea.
Uh-huh.
It could be a title. I write a lot of times off of titles, or it could just be, you know, just some idea that, yeah, this would be good to develop in some way. But when I'm doing that, I always kind of have at least the sketch of a melody in mind, or at least a style. You know, this should be a blues song. Mm-hmm. This should sound like bluegrass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, so I can kind of orient it musically. If I'm just writing pure lyrics to the point where, you know, it's just poetry or something, that doesn't really work for me personally.
Mm-hmm. So the really flowery lyrical songs aren't so much your style.
No, I find that I get easily lost that way. I mean, there's a lot of great writers that write that way, and, you know, and I like a lot of those kinds of songs. But for me personally, if I kind of drift off too far from the title idea or, you know, the concept of the song, I get lost.
Well, the title of this song is Me and Robert Kraft. I think, do I have that right?
Well, I actually call it Robert Kraft. It sort of goes both ways, but it could, and I can talk about that. But I guess the official title is Robert Kraft and Me.
Okay. It does actually go both ways in the song, and I think it having to do with your rhyme scheme.
Exactly.
But I heard this, and I was just laughing out loud. I think it's hysterical.
Thank you.
So give us some background on this whole thing and how this all came about.
Yeah, okay. I guess the first thing I need to mention is that will become relevant in a minute is I have a real estate broker's license. There's not really a good reason for me to have a real estate broker's license. I'm not a real estate broker.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, it's almost comical that I have a real estate broker's license given how little I know about real estate. And so I don't really use it. The main reason I got it many years ago is my mom was a real estate agent. And there were times where, you know, after I grew up where maybe she had a conflict, she couldn't make it to an open house or something. And she needed or thought she might need me just to sit in, mm-hmm. You know, at the house so that there would be a licensed agent there. Which almost never happened.
Yeah.
But when it did happen, it was almost embarrassing how little I knew. You know, the most basic thing, you know, they would ask me what kind of heat the house has and that kind of stuff. I wouldn't know, you know. But I always had the license, and I've just maintained it over the years. And again, not for really any good reason other than I just, you know, I didn't give it up. So the way it works in Massachusetts is your license gets renewed every 2 years. And so fast forward now to 2019, or the license renewal date for this is your birthday. So my birthday is in February. Mm-hmm. So my license was going to renew in February of 2019. So sometime in late 18 or early 19, I get the renewal package. And what used to happen is you would just fill out a little form and send a check in, and they would send you your new license. But this time they had a whole communication where they said, we're not going to do it that way anymore. You can only renew online. Okay, so that's fine. And the deadline was my birthday, so I marked that on my calendar. I was cognizant of that. I didn't feel any need to like do it a month in advance or anything like that. But you have to do it before your birthday, or you can still renew your license, but there's a late fee. And I forget what it was, but it was something like $50 or $60 or something in that range. So it was the day before my birthday. I had this marked on my calendar, and I went to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts website to renew my license. And when I went onto the site, there was a message there saying, our site is down for service for the next 3 days. So I sent an email, you know, there was contact information there, and I sent an email and said, you know, my license is set to renew tomorrow. I just went online to renew it, but your site's down. As soon as it comes back on in 3 days, I'll complete the process of renewing my license. I assume I won't be charged a late fee in the interim because your site is down. They responded fairly quickly. it was somebody that had a very impressive sounding title, like director of licensing or something like that. And I came to learn later that, notwithstanding the impressive title, I think they were right out of college or something and didn't have a lot of experience. But it basically said, you are responsible for renewing your license on time. If you do not do that, that is your fault. We are not responsible. A late fee will be charged. There are no exceptions. So I kind of figured, and I think this turned out to be correct, that's just basically a form letter they use because people have all sorts of excuses couldn't renew on time, but not that the site is down, so you have no option to do so. So I wrote back. I tried to be very polite and said, you know, I understand that's your normal policy. But this seems like that shouldn't apply because, you know, it's not my fault that I can't renew it. Yeah. Your site is down. And again, I got back a response, and I forget exactly what it said, but the essence of it was, what part about no exceptions do you not understand?
Oh my God.
So by now, and I think I was kind of having a bad day to begin with, you know, so by now I'm kind of perturbed. And just on impulse, I think I've been reading the Globe that day, and I read the paper regularly, and I'm a fan of their consumer reporter, Sean Murphy. I think he does a really good job, you know.
Yeah.
Because not only does he take a strong position in favor of the consumer, which is, you know, good, but to me, he always, notwithstanding that, tries to be fair and accurate, and I really enjoy his column. I didn't know him or anything. But just out of frustration, I took those messages from the state and I forwarded them to him, it was really just a blow off steam. I did not expect to hear back from him over my $50 issue.
Yeah.
But sure enough, I think it was probably the next day, I got an email from him. He said, you know, are you still having that problem? Yes, I am. I'd like to talk to you about it. So I called him, we spoke, and it was funny. The first thing he said to me was, are you the songwriter?
Really?
Yeah. So that, you know, felt good that, you know, yeah. He knew who I was. And it turns out he's, you know, a folk music fan.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, is this really a story? You know, and he said, well, yes, my editor thinks it's a story.
Yeah.
And I guess the angle was that, you know, it's the state bureaucracy and all of that. So, you know, unfeeling. And he said, we'd like to write a story about this. And he interviewed me and they sent out a photographer to take my picture. It sort of was taking on a life of its own. and then a few days later, when the site was back up, I went online to renew my license, yeah, expecting I'm going to get this late fee, and there was no late fee charged.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually called him back and said, I don't think there's a story here. They wound up not even imposing the late fee. And he said, no, we think the reason they did that was because we had made inquiry.
Ah.
So they still thought there was a story. So yeah, so anyway, and I remember on my birthday, it turned out I played a show with the great Christine Lab, and I was telling her about it. And, you know, I think I told her, I, you know, sent it off to the Globe. And, you know, she said what many people say in these situations. Oh, you ought to write a song about it.
You know, I was going to ask how many times people actually say that to you.
Right, which is, I'll talk about. I usually don't really take that advice to heart. But anyway, so at a certain point, we learned the story. You know, they took my photo. We learned the story was going to run. I think it was the next Saturday morning. I get up and get the paper. I actually still get the, you know, hard copy of the paper.
Yeah.
And I knew the story was going to be in there, but I thought it would be somewhere, you know, buried on the business page or the, you know, the metro section or whatever it is. And there it is on the front page. So I thought that was kind of amusing.
Yeah.
And now I'm hearing from people about it. And again, everybody says, oh, you ought to write a song about this, which, you know, I hear a lot, but I, like I said, I almost never take that to heart, mainly because I very rarely write songs about my own personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm usually trying to write from, you know, an imagined perspective or a character's perspective or whatever it is. So I'm usually not inclined to do that, but I started thinking about it. This is kind of a humorous experience, being on the front page of the paper, and it's nice to be on the front page of the paper without it, you know, being a scandal or anything.
And Christina suggested it even before you made it to the front page.
Correct.
So
that's right. That's right. So she'll
make a funny song.
That was going around in my head, and so I'm like, is there a way that I can, you know, make a whole song out of this silly experience? And I don't think I realized right away that you know, the same morning that I was on the front page of the paper, there was another larger story breaking, which was the problem that Robert Kraft had at the Orchids of Asia.
Yeah.
And that his paper, his picture was on the paper, front page of the paper too. And I think I was talking to somebody and they're like, oh, your photo was larger than Robert Kraft's on there, you know? And
Kraft had something to do with that.
Yeah. So that kind of gave me the entree. I'm like, well, maybe I can do something with that.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and then I was also talking to some. You know, I'm a Patriot fan. You know, I actually have season tickets, And so I was talking to somebody about it. I remember I used the phrase, I said, yeah, it's kind of sad, you know. And then I was thinking, it's kind of sad, but it's kind of funny too, you know. And so then really it was one of these situations where the lines came to me out of the blue, which is always nice as a songwriter. Mm-hmm. And so it was, Robert Kraft was busted in a prostitution sting. And that was kind of sad, I guess. But here's the funny thing. And once I had those lines, I'm like, yeah, I can write this song.
There you
song.
Go. Now you've got the pattern and you've got right. to.
I've got a way sort of, yeah. I've got a way in yeah. to the story. Yep. And so I remember at that point, I'm like, yeah, I can write this song and it should be about me and Robert Kraft being on the front page of the paper at the same time. And so I remember the next thing I did was I didn't know whether it should, we were talking about this before, I didn't know whether the song should be called Me and Robert Kraft or Robert Kraft and mm-hmm. Me. I didn't know. So what I did was I wrote down every rhyme I could think of for Kraft
yeah.
and for me. And it turns out there were good ones for both of them.
Yeah.
So I kind of use it that phrase interchangeably. As a title, though, I don't know. I just think Robert Kraft and Me kind of maybe stands a little better. I'm not really sure. But so that's what I call it. Once I had the ability to rhyme both those words, now I could really develop the story. And obviously, I could develop by, you know, bringing up things that either I have in common or are different between me and Robert Kraft.
So, you know, what you came up with was actually sort of writing about the subplot of the whole big picture of you with the fighting the whole bureaucracy and everything. That was the first big
right.
Storyline. And now you found that secondary plot that
right. Well, I felt like in the first verse I had to kind of explain a little bit, you mm-hmm. know, that we were both on the front page of the paper, and,
yeah.
and that gets explained a little more in the second verse where I'm like, you know, it was he had this problem, I had this problem. Coincidentally, it yeah. happened at the same
yeah.
time. Coincidentally was something that rhymed with Robert Kraft and me, so I thought I could
right.
use that, you know. And then kind of where the song goes at that point, because now I've explained it, is you know, there are some things that Robert Kraft and I do not have in common. He's a billionaire, I'm a folk singer, you know, and things like that. So I try to expand on that, and
yeah.
yet we had this thing in common that we're both on the front page of the paper at the same time. And then the other line, I think this came as a result of me talking to somebody, was I pictured sort of Robert Kraft going out like I did that Saturday morning and picking up the newspaper. And there's his picture, and there's my picture. And so I'm thinking that, you know, when he looked at the front page, just for that moment, he said, I wish I were that guy. And I don't know if that really happened. But
no,
I thought,
not.
Again, that was sort of another, you know, another approach that I used in the song.
Yeah. I don't think he went to the end of his driveway in his bathrobe and slippers and picked up the paper.
I don't know that
it's
that happened.
It's hard to imagine that.
Either. Yes, but that's what I was picturing
yeah.
in my head. And so that was really, and then so the song was very easy to write. Other than the last verse, I knew it needed, you know, I knew it needed a joke at the end to carry it, and I really wasn't sure how to do that. So it actually took me a while to do that. At first, I had like an idea. Oh, we both got screwed, or
mm-hmm.
you know, but. That wasn't really funny,
yeah.
and technically it probably technically it probably wasn't accurate either, you know.
That's true.
But by that time, you know, it was a big story, and there were a lot of jokes going around about
yeah.
happy endings, so
yeah.
called. And so I thought that, you know, yeah, that's what I should do. I can do that, you know. So, you know, I said, you know, maybe it was fitting because, as far as I can tell, my story had a happy ending, and I guess his did as well. And once I had that, that was sort of like the last joke.
It's like, this is one of those, when those lines come to you, you just, the heavens open up and you just go,
Right, that was good, that was helpful to me, because not only was it a good joke to end the song on, but, you know, when you're putting this together, it's sort of like a jigsaw puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can fit that last piece, it's
yeah.
always
and
nice.
Tie it all together.
So, yeah.
Well, it's so humorous.
Thank you.
And if you had, if you had one most funny song that you've written, what was it about?
Oh, wow. That's hard. I've got a number of them that, you know, get good responses from a crowd that I still play regularly. I've got a number of holiday songs that are humorous. I have a song called Kitty is a Cougar that gets a lot of laughs usually. I have a song called Excuse Me for Living that gets a lot of I have a lot of songs about alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that is. I don't really drink that much, but that's kind of a good subject for me for a humorous.
Probably channeling some folk singer.
Or country singers. Yeah. When in doubt, that's sort of one of my go-to subjects. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of songs about that. One's called Beer View Mirror. That usually gets some laughs.
Yeah.
I have another one that was on my very first record that gets a lot of laughs. It's called Daniel's Walker and Beam. And it sort of pictures those three types of whiskey as an accounting firm.
So do you find if you're at a gathering with people, there's no musical instruments or anything, are you telling jokes?
Obviously
you have a good sense of humor and
yeah, thanks. But, I don't really do any stand up or anything like that, but sure, I like humor stories and I am for the live performances, in addition to the songs, I'm frequently, particularly the more humorous ones, I'm frequently thinking about how I can set them up in a humorous way, so. I like a good laugh.
Yeah, that's great. I can't remember a joke for the life of me. People tell me jokes, and I just cannot remember them.
Sure.
But I'd like to think I have a good sense of humor and I can make people laugh, but probably the self-deprecating kind is the best.
Well, like I said, when you're using a sort of a humor story or whatever to set up the songs, there's a little bit of trial and error involved in that. I find that over time, the pattern for the songs evolves until you... There's a point where you're like, yeah, this is how I should introduce the song.
Yeah.
So
do you play this song? Do you always play it solo?
Or the bass player? Yeah. So here's the story with that. So I just recorded it myself. But by now, I guess it's probably May. This whole thing happened in February, but it took me a while to write the song and then whatever. And then I was actually, Christine again asked me to, she asked me to be on the bill for a multi-artist tribute to Pete Seeger that took place in his hometown of Beacon, New York. And so I was backstage with her. I don't think I had seen her since that February when we had the show. And I said, guess what? I explained everything that happened. I said, I wrote a song about it and I played it for her in the green room. And she's like, do you have a recording of that? I said, yeah, I just made one. And she's like, can you send it to me? And so I did. And so she had a bass player friend that I got sitting here now. I cannot remember his name. I should remember that.
Yeah.
But he added bass to it, really as a favor, to me through Christine, and a vocal, and sent it back. So that's the other instrument on that. So I've that year I played it quite a bit.
Yes,
and obviously there have been a lot of shows.
It was timely, right?
Right. At a certain point, probably the shelf life is up for it. But but I think I never actually played it with anybody else. If I played it live, I would usually do harmonica on it too. But that's who the other musician is on the recording.
Mm-hmm. The bass player.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, have you sent this song to the Kraft Organization?
I did not send it to the Kraft Organization. I did send it to Sean Murphy.
Yeah.
And he really liked it. And I also sent it to Lee Monfil, who wrote for the Globe for many years.
Sure.
Because
sports writer.
Yeah, so Lee is actually, I don't want to overstate it, but I think he's a fan of mine, which is very flattering. Uh-huh. And several years ago I played a show that was hosted by his significant other, and he introduced me, and which was great, and we chatted, and I was so happy about that, because I read Lee Monfil ever since I was a kid, and I think he's just a fantastic writer. He's one of the best writers I know. And I've read his books, and so I've kept up a little bit of correspondence with him over the years, and so I sent it to him as well, just because of the Globe connection, and he enjoyed it too. I didn't really think there was a point in sending it to the Kraft Organization.
You would want to have a lawyer on
right. Plus, they wouldn't necessarily the story wouldn't mean anything to them, necessarily. that I happened to be on the front page of the Globe the same day.
But I just wondered what they're in. No, I assumed that you didn't, but I felt like I had to ask.
Right.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us on Song Creating. It's a terrific song, and whether it's me and Robert Kraft or Robert Kraft and me, it's a brilliant take, And we really appreciate you being here. Why don't you tell us how we can hear more of your music and find more information?
Well, my website is markstepakoff.com, www.markstepakoff.com.
Let's spell Stepakoff.
That's S-T-E-P-A-K-O-F-F.
Okay.
It's Mark with a K. So I'm pretty diligent about keeping that up to date with anything that would be happening musically for me. So you could check that. And then, I'm on all the usual streaming services. My music's usually not that hard to find.
Well, thank you, Mark. We're going to leave with your brilliant rendition of Robert Kraft and Me.
Thanks,
okay, Mark.
Been a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks very much.
Well, Robert Kraft was busted in a prostitution sting. That was kind of sad, I guess, but here's the funny thing. The next day in the Boston Globe, for everyone to see, were two photos on the front page. It was Robert Kraft and me. They said he had received an inappropriate massage while I renewed a realtor's license and was overcharged. Both stories ran the same day, just coincidentally. And so right there on the front page, it was Robert Kraft and me. Well, he's a famous billionaire, a man of great acclaim, while I'm a folk musician, so nobody knows my name. Because the board of licensure had given me the shaft. On the front page of the paper, it was me and Robert Kraft. Now, while I don't own a football team, I'm sure it would be fun to be buddies with Bon Jovi or hang out with Elton John. But when he opened up the Globe that day, I'm thinking probably that at least for that one morning, Robert Kraft wished he was me. Well, in the end, the state had waived my license fee, and so why it merited a front page story, I'm not sure I know. But when my friends and family saw it, they just laughed and laughed and laughed. 'Cause on the front page of the Boston Globe were me and Robert Kraft. But maybe it was fitting, 'cause as far as I can tell, my story had a happy ending, and I guess his did as well. And now I feel I sort of know him, since we both were photographed on the front page of the Boston Globe. Yes, me and Robert Kraft.
Thanks for listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM. To listen to more episodes, head over to songcreating.com. You can also find us on Amazon Music and Stitcher. And to check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart.